You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
In trying to recount for people who asked you that morning and over the next couple days, some of what's reflected in those text messages, was that part of your state of mind?
Yes.
Was it in any way affecting the way you were remembering and thinking about what had happened?
Objection. I'll allow it.
Yes.
Your Honor, subject to redactions, I would seek to introduce all of Ms. McCabe's text messages.
So we'll deal with that later. Is there an objection?
There is.
We'll deal with that later.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I have no further questions.
Ms. McCabe, a couple of follow-up questions. You indicated on redirect examination that there were no sirens that you heard that morning with the approach of the first responders. Is that right?
I don't believe there was.
But they did have their lights on.
I saw a spotlight, yes, and I do believe they had lights on, yes.
Flashing red and blue lights or blue lights or red lights, some combination thereof, correct?
Correct.
That was cruisers, police cruisers, correct?
Yes.
There were fire SUVs, in other words, a captain of a fire department?
Possibly.
There were fire trucks and fire engines. Do you know the difference?
No.
Fire engine, big one with a ladder on it?
Yes.
There was an ambulance, correct?
Yes.
And all of them had their emergency lights on?
Most likely, yes.
All of them had their motors running?
I'm not sure if they were all running. They could have been, yes.
Certainly, you would agree that there was a cacophony of diesel engines and gasoline engines and internal combustion engines that were running right outside of 34 Fairview, although no sirens, correct?
I wouldn't exactly say right outside of 34 Fairview. I'd say there were some right outside of 34 Fairview, but the first vehicle pulled up kind of right just on the right end, and most of the vehicles with the lights on were to the left, so they were actually more in front of 32 Fairview. But there were vehicles. There was Miss Roberts' vehicle, and then I believe another vehicle pulled up, I think I remember from seeing the dash cam.
And Sarah's cruiser, correct?
Yes.
And Mulaney's cruiser, just on the other side of Terry Roberts' vehicle, correct?
Yes, I don't believe his lights were on.
And there was an ambulance just to the left and behind Sarah's vehicle, correct?
Yes, which would have been in front of 32 Fairview.
Lights on that as well?
Yes.
All facing in the direction of 34 Fairview, correct?
Facing, but out front of 32.
So is there a reason that you're so resistant to admit that there was a cacophony of sound and noise outside of 34 Fairview?
No.
Okay, so there was, correct?
Outside on the front lawn, yes, yeah. Side lawn.
And there was also some people yelling and screaming at a high pitch, right?
Yes.
Both Miss Reed, who was yelling and screaming, correct?
Correct.
And Miss Roberts, who at least at some point told her to shut the fuck up, correct?
Correct.
You were asked about the stop at 34 Fairview on the way to Sergeant Lang's house on redirect examination by Mr. Brennan just now, correct?
I was, yes.
He showed you a couple of pages of your transcript from that question and answer, correct?
I believe he showed me a page, yes.
And you noted that this was a question and answer from a hearing last year in this courtroom?
Yes.
And you admitted that you stopped, but actually, let me rephrase that. You were confronted with the fact that you stopped at 34 Fairview on the way to Officer Lang's house, Sergeant Lang's house, by me on cross-examination, correct?
Yes, you asked me.
You also indicated that you have never refused to speak to the police, any law enforcement officer in this case, correct?
I've spoken when asked to, yes.
But in point of fact, when you were approached by the two law enforcement agents who were not connected to Massachusetts State Police or to Canton PD, you suspended that interview and refused to answer further questions, correct?
I welcomed them in my house, sat with them, and then I stopped, and then I met with them a few times after, and I answered all their questions that they asked. I helped clear up some misconceptions that they had been told, and as you know they're no longer investigating, so I think I helped them well.
And you're obviously well aware that in that first interview, you stopped the interview cold and refused to answer further questions, correct?
I said, I'm going to stop and I'm going to seek some counsel, yes.
The text messages. You just read a series of text messages that Mr. Brennan actually read for you and you agreed with, correct?
Correct.
Were any of the text messages that you just read in the group chat that I showed you in cross-examination?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so.
And that group chat included you, Brian Albert, Nicole Albert, and Matt McCabe, correct?
Correct.
And that was a private chat among the four of you. Is that right?
That's stick to the street, yes.
You read some text messages to and from Kerry Roberts, correct?
Yes.
You had just met Kerry Roberts, isn't that right?
Yes.
She's not a McCabe, is that right?
Correct.
She's not an Albert, correct?
Correct.
You even read some text messages with your minor children, correct?
Just now?
Yeah.
I don't believe any with my children.
Mr. Brennan asked you about a couple of text messages, or at least one text message, with your children, didn't he?
No, he didn't.
Objection.
Yeah. She can answer that question. Is that what happened?
Did I misunderstand?
No, I honestly didn't read anything from my children. I think one, I said a friend, another time I didn't know who it was, but I do know my children's phone numbers, and no, it was none of my kids.
Obviously, the kids are not on that group chat, that private group chat that we went over, correct?
Oh, yes, correct. They're not.
Well, let's talk about those unidentified numbers. You said this is a number I don't recognize, and Mr. Brennan read to you a text to that person, correct?
Yes.
Whoever that is, that person's not a McCabe, correct?
They're not one. Correct.
And that person's not an Albert?
They could be. Again, it could have been Chris Albert. Julie, I don't. One of the numbers I didn't recognize, because I have everybody in my phone with the name, so I don't recognize every number.
And that person certainly was not in that group chat with you, Brian Albert, Nicole Albert, and Matt McCabe, correct?
Correct.
And then there was a friend. You said this is a friend, and I don't need you to identify the friend, but whoever this unidentified friend is, that friend is not a McCabe and is not an Albert, correct?
Correct.
And that friend was also not in that group chat that we went over in cross-examination, is that right?
Correct.
These are all people outside of that group, among whom you engaged in the chat that we saw, correct?
Correct.
And that includes Kerry Roberts. She was not included in that group chat where you talked about the case and talked about what she was and wasn't doing with law enforcement, right?
Correct. It was just my sister, my brother-in-law, and husband.
Yeah, just a moment, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, that's all I have.
All right. Ms. McCabe, you are all set. Thank you very much.
I'm just going to do that. Thank you.
All right.
I'd like to play a couple of clips, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'd ask you to just wait 10 seconds.
I'm sorry.
All right, you can play them now.
Okay. May I proceed?
Yes.
I'd like to play clip 12, please.
Who was a mother to kids that were close to John's kids, who lived very close to the Alberts. In fact, when Jen was navigating John to the Alberts when I was driving, she said, it's near Ashley's house. Ashley and John were hooked up prior to John and I dating. There was a woman...
Hold on. Hold on before you play it again.
We've already played that one. We don't need to play it again.
Okay.
12A, please.
Two things. Either he's hurt himself and is incapacitated. He could be passed out on someone's couch, which is just weird. We're not on a campus. Everyone lives in their own home with children. Or he's sleeping with someone. And there were multiple women in the neighborhood of Fairview that John had been with. And one of them very recently before I started dating John.
Clip 16, please.
We'll backtrack later to
I'm with Jen McCabe and Carrie Roberts, and Carrie Roberts is Ford Explorer. And I'm in the back, leaning over the front two seats. Carrie's driving and Jen's in the passenger seat. And I describe this to everyone, so you've probably heard this before, but John looked like a buffalo on the prairie. It was just a lawn and a heap that, it wasn't a bush or a hydrant or a dog. It was a weird shaped lump at that time in those elements. And I was looking to find him on the side of the road. I was expecting I'd find him. And the fear of what I was gonna see is the worst feeling I've ever experienced. The anticipation of what is awaiting me was as extreme a feeling, I wouldn't say it was as extreme a feeling as the grief of realizing what happened to him.
And finally, clip 17, please.
Your Honor, we need to see the court before this one's going.
All right, hold that, please.
You're on the phone with calling Ms. Hannah Knowles to the stand.
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you shall give to the court and the jury in the matter now pending shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you God?
Yes, I do. Good afternoon. All right, Mr. Lally, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon.
Could you please introduce yourself to the jury and spell your last name for the court?
Certainly. My name is Hannah Knowles. My last name is spelled K-N-O-W-L-E-S.
And what is your occupation?
I'm a forensic scientist at the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab.
And prior to working at the lab, where did you go to school?
I have a Bachelor of Science from Simmons University in Boston and a Master's of Science in Forensic Science from the George Washington University.
And how long have you worked at the State Police Lab?
Since October of 2006.
And in what capacity do you work there now?
I'm currently a Forensic Scientist 4 in the Toxicology Unit.
Now, when you joined the State Police Lab, what was your position and title that you were initially hired for?
I was initially hired as a Chemist 1 in the Drug Identification or Narcotics Unit. After about a year in that position, I was promoted to a Chemist 2 position. After about a year, there was a position available in the Toxicology Unit, so I applied for that available position, transferred to the Tox Unit in about August of 2007. And have been in the toxicology unit ever since.
And Ms. Knowles, briefly, if you could describe sort of what is the difference between a Chemist 1 and a Chemist 2?
At the time, the job series for folks that worked at the crime lab was the Chemist series. A Chemist 1 was an entry-level or trainee-type position where the individual was responsible for progressing through the training program and assisting with casework as they are authorized on different modules. Chemist 2 was a bench-level analyst, someone who had completed training or had a significant amount of authorizations and could work on casework and worked independently from that point forward.
And similarly, what is sort of the difference between a Chemist 2 and a Chemist 3?
The Chemist 3 series that was in place prior to 2014 was a first-level supervisory role. It was somebody who oversaw the day-to-day operations and the work of forensic scientists 1 and 2, or chemists 1 and 2.
And what are your current duties and responsibilities at the State Police Lab?
In 2014, those chemist classifications that I was describing got changed to forensic scientists. Forensic scientists 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 is the series. Currently, I'm a forensic scientist 4. And so my role is overseeing training and validation for the toxicology unit.
Is there a continuing educational component to your work at the lab?
Yes, there is.
And can you describe that for the jury, please?
As part of our accreditation, analysts are required to participate in continuing education at least once per year as they continue to work in their role. Continuing education can consist of participating in workshops or webinars, attending conferences or meetings, or documenting ongoing literature review of new journal articles as they're published.
What is proficiency testing?
Proficiency testing is something that we utilize in the laboratory to assess processes and competencies of an individual, as well as the processes that are in place for a particular unit or department or scope of testing. Proficiency testing is also an accreditation requirement. Individuals are required by our internal processes to participate in proficiency testing at least once per year as sort of an ongoing assessment. And what a proficiency test is materials that are purchased by the laboratory from a third-party vendor. Those materials are analyzed as if they were casework, but there are expected results or known results for those samples. Once the laboratory processes those samples, just like their casework, we submit the results to the external vendor that we purchase the materials from. The results are compared to the expected results, and we have to have our results meet those expected results in order for the proficiency test to be considered successful.
Now, over the course of your years at the lab, have you undergone proficiency testing?
Yes, I have.
And have you passed each of those respective proficiency tests that you've taken?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
Now, is the State Police Lab accredited?
Yes, it is.
And by whom?
The Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab is currently accredited by the American National Standards Institute National Accreditation Board.
And what does that accreditation process consist of?
The accreditation process consists of on-site assessments as well as remote or virtual assessments to evaluate our policies and procedures, our personnel, our management, as well as our facilities to ensure that we are meeting established accreditation standards. The standards that we're currently accredited to is an international standard 17025 with additional requirements for forensic testing laboratories. And so there are folks that come from that organization, ANAB, that come to evaluate all of those different aspects of our processes to ensure that we are meeting the standards set out in their requirements.
And the State Police Lab in particular, the toxicology unit within that lab, is that accreditation up to date at this point?
Yes, we're currently accredited to that standard.
Now, just in general terms, Ms. Knowles, if you could explain to the jury, what is forensic science?
Forensic science generally is the application of science to questions of law.
And just again, in sort of general terms, if you could explain to the jury, what is toxicology?
Toxicology generally is a study of chemicals and other substances and how they impact a living organism or a person.
Now, asking a little more specifically, what is forensic toxicology?
Forensic toxicology is generally looking at drugs and alcohol in the human body and how it affects the individual and applying chemistry and other disciplines to measure the concentration or determine the presence or absence of relevant substances.
Are there different types of alcohol?
Yes, there are.
Okay. And what are those types?
Generally, alcohols are a family or a group of drugs or chemicals that have a specific functional group or a specific structure. The types of alcohols that are analyzed in the laboratory that I work include methanol, ethanol, and isopropanol.
And what are the differences between those different types?
They all have similar but slightly different structures. Methanol is a solvent. Sometimes it's called wood grain alcohol. Isopropanol is rubbing alcohol or 2-propanol. And that is typically used as a disinfectant. And ethanol is the type of alcohol that we typically are referring to when we talk about alcoholic beverages. It's what's present in those types of liquids.
Now, Ms. Knowles, through your training and experience, are you familiar with a term known as a central nervous system depressant?
Yes, I am.
And can you explain that term to the jury?
Sure. A central nervous system depressant is a drug or a substance that works to slow down the reactions of nerves in your body. It makes nerve cells slower or less likely to respond to stimulus.
Now, is alcohol a central nervous system depressant?
Yes, it is.
And how would that central nervous system depressant affect the human body?
The effects depend on the concentration or the amount that's present in the body. Effects range, depending on that concentration, from slowing reaction time, reducing heart rate or respiration rate in an individual. That slower respiration rate can also result in drowsiness or unconsciousness. Slower reaction time and more limited muscle control can also result in outward appearances like a staggering gait or slurred speech. It can impair balance and motor coordination. Because nerves are responding more slowly, alcohol can also, or ethanol specifically, can impact your brain's ability to form new memories. It can impact your body's ability to perceive and apply critical thinking. again, all of those effects that I just described, they can be present depending on the concentration and the individual and how they're responding to that particular concentration of ethanol at any particular time.
Now, how is work assigned within the state police lab, specifically within the toxicology unit?
Generally, supervisors will come up with a monthly schedule or rotation where the different types of work in the unit are divided amongst authorized analysts. And then casework is assigned according to that rotation. If an individual has previously been assigned work for that case or has previously issued a report for that case, then sometimes we go off rotation and assign a case according to that previous involvement or previous report that was issued for the case.
Now, at some point, were you assigned to perform some work on a lab case number 22-06576 pertaining to this defendant, Karen Reed?
Yes, I was.
And what is it that you were asked to do?
I was asked to prepare a serum conversion report and a retrograde extrapolation report relative to this case.
Now, how many serum conversions have you conducted during your years at the lab?
I've prepared over 100 serum conversion reports since I was authorized in 2008.
And how many retrograde analyses have you conducted during your years at the lab?
I would say approximately 15.
Now, starting with a serum conversion, can you please explain to the jury what a serum conversion is and how it is that it's conducted?
Certainly. A serum conversion is a service that the laboratory offers when a blood or a serum ethanol concentration has been determined, and it would be helpful or relevant for us to approximate what a corresponding whole blood alcohol concentration would be. When we're talking about blood alcohol concentrations or blood ethanol concentrations and serum ethanol concentrations, serum ethanol concentrations are always higher than a blood alcohol concentration. If you had a blood and a serum sample that were collected from the same person at the same time, you would always expect the serum alcohol to be between 13 and 19% higher than the whole blood. So for that reason, that difference between the two, this service that we offer can assist to approximate what a corresponding whole blood ethanol concentration would be based on testing on a serum ethanol concentration.
And did you have occasion to perform a serum conversion with respect to this defendant?
Yes, I did.
And what materials or documents did you receive in order to perform that analysis?
For the serum conversion, I referred to medical records that were provided with a request.
Your Honor, may I approach and retrieve what's been previously marked as Exhibit 37?
Yes.
May I approach the witness?
Yes.
I'm showing you a document. Do you recognize that document? May I approach again, Your Honor?
Yes. Yes. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Turning your attention to a previously tabbed portion of those records. It's the 52nd page of those records. Do you recognize that?
Yes, the flagged page is consistent with the portion of the medical records that I had reviewed in preparation for doing the serum conversion calculations for this report.
And those medical records pertain to a Ms. Karen Reed from the Good Samaritan Medical Center, is that correct?
Yes, they do.
Okay. And in those records on that 52nd page, what was reported as the defendant's ethanol level?
The results are recorded as an alcohol result with a value of 93 milligrams per deciliter.
And pursuant to those records, at what time was that sample taken from the defendant at the Good Samaritan Medical Center?
The collection time listed on the medical records is January 29th, 2022 at 9:08 a.m.
Now, that recording and a measurement of milligrams per deciliter, is that typical for how you see ethanol measured by hospital labs?
Yes.
And did you conduct the serum conversion for this defendant's reading consistently with how you do in every case that's assigned to you?
Yes.
Now, please explain to the jury how you're able to convert that serum level reading to a blood alcohol concentration.
So the way that the calculation is performed is kind of in two steps. So the results are listed in milligrams per deciliter, which is common in clinical testing. And to convert it to the type of units that are typically used for blood alcohol concentrations, we just divide by 1,000 to get that into the right units. So 93 milligrams per deciliter converts to 0.093 grams per cent. And then to perform the serum conversion, or to get this serum ethanol concentration into what we would estimate to be a blood alcohol concentration, we apply two conversion factors, a low and a high conversion factor, to account for the range that we see in the typical population. I'd mentioned earlier that serum is usually between 13 to 19% higher. So we divide that 0.093 by 1.13 and by 1.19 to get a low and a high blood alcohol concentration for that range.
And those conversion factors that you just mentioned, where do those come from?
The conversion factors come from literature, where they've performed experiments similar to how I described. They have individuals that have ingested ethanol. They collect samples from them and test their whole blood and test their serum alcohol concentrations, and then compare them and see what the ratio is between them. The current ratios that are used by the laboratory, the 13 and 19%, those are also consistent with consensus body documents, or sort of industry standards that we utilize and base our protocols upon.
Now, that 13 and 19%, how long have those conversion factors been in place?
There was a consensus body document published in 2024, and so we adjusted the serum conversion factors that had previously been in use to those new published, or those new recommendations, in September of 2024.
Now, does the change in conversion factors recently adopted by your lab, does that benefit the patient or the person for whom you're converting the ethanol to blood alcohol concentration?
Objection.
I'll allow it. Does it?
The previous factors were, we used between 12 and 18%. And so when you perform that conversion, it typically ends up with a equivalent or lower blood alcohol concentration. And so it could be interpreted as being favorable to a defendant.
Now, why are they presented in a range?
We don't use just one conversion factor. Because in the studies that we base our procedures on, it demonstrates that the general population does not have one consistent conversion factor or ratio between their whole blood and their serum alcohol concentrations. And so to ensure that the conversion that we're utilizing applies to most of the general population, we use sort of the extremes of what we see in that literature, like a high and a low, to make sure that our approximation falls, that the true value would fall somewhere in between that low and that high value.
And what did you calculate as a low and a high range for this defendant's blood alcohol concentration from that alcohol reading from the Good Samaritan Medical Center?
So the 93 milligrams per deciliter serum ethanol concentration would convert to between 0.078 and 0.092% or grams per cent.
And again, Ms. Knowles, that's at the time that the blood is drawn at approximately 9:08 a.m. on January 29th. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, turning your attention to retrograde extrapolation, can you explain to the jury what a retrograde extrapolation is?
Sure. A retrograde extrapolation is another service that the laboratory offers, where it's a calculation that we can perform when We have a alcohol concentration that was measured at a particular time, and it would be helpful or relevant to know what that person's blood alcohol concentration was at some point prior to that sample having been collected. What we're doing with this calculation is taking what we know about how quickly the human body is capable of breaking down alcohol and applying that rate of elimination to the time interval between when the sample was collected and tested and when there might be a particular time of interest, a car accident or some interaction where that person's blood alcohol concentration might be relevant.
And how is that done?
Similar to the range of conversion factors that we were looking at with the serum conversion, we know that the rate of elimination in alcohol in humans varies from person to person. And so based on studies where they're looking at rates of elimination in large groups of people, we know that alcohol can break down at a rate of between 0.010 and 0.025% per hour. And so we take the, when we're looking at a serum conversion and then being combined with a retrograde, we take the smaller of the serum conversion range and we add that to the slowest elimination rate multiplied by a time interval. And then we also take the larger of the serum conversion values, and then we add that to the fastest elimination rate multiplied by the time interval. We use a smaller time interval for that sort of minimum calculation to account for the fact that we don't want to overshoot that estimate of blood alcohol concentration. If there was some unabsorbed alcohol, we don't necessarily always know when we perform these calculations, the drinking history or like when the person had stopped drinking that day. And so we usually subtract 2 hours from the time interval when we're doing that minimum calculation to have a more conservative estimate. So we're applying the time interval, the rates of elimination, and looking at what we have for blood alcohol concentrations, all to be considered when we're performing the calculation.
Now, what categories of information do you need in order to perform a retrograde analysis?
We need to know what the blood alcohol concentration was at the time that the sample was collected. We need to know the time the sample was collected, and we need to know the incident time or the time of interest that we're sort of calculating back to. There's a couple of requirements to be able to perform this calculation that we have to ensure. We have to make sure that there's at least been 2 hours in that time interval between the time of collection and the time of interest that we're looking at. We can't calculate backwards with that very narrow window because we can't be sure that the person is entirely in the elimination phase, that their body has reached a maximum blood alcohol concentration and they're just breaking down alcohol at that point. And we also know that this simple rate of elimination calculation can't be accurately modeled once we get down below between 0.02 and 0.03. So we have to make sure that the starting blood alcohol concentration is at least an 0.03 or higher in order to be able to apply that math.
Now, how is it that alcohol is metabolized within the body?
Generally, after someone stops drinking alcohol, their body reaches a maximum blood alcohol concentration. And then after that maximum is reached, for most folks, that's between 30 and 90 minutes after they stop drinking. And then the body breaks the alcohol down over time in a very predictable linear fashion, down until it gets down into about 0.02 and 0.03. The mechanism that the body uses to metabolize, some alcohol is excreted in urine, Some alcohol is evaporated and removed from the body through your breath, but the vast majority is broken down with enzymes in your body that convert the ethanol structure into water and carbon dioxide.
What are the phases of metabolism for alcohol in the body?
So alcohol, once it's ingested, moves through the body in a couple of different phases. One, initially, the body is absorbing alcohol. Then the alcohol is distributed throughout the body where it can have its effects. There's the metabolism phase and then elimination. Most drugs and alcohol all kind of follow that same pattern in these different phases. And so I'd mentioned elimination phase earlier. That's after you've reached a maximum blood alcohol concentration and your body is no longer absorbing. It's fully distributed in your body, and then you're just breaking it down and removing, your body's removing the alcohol or the ethanol from your system.
Now, in a retrograde analysis, are you calculating for a single number or something else?
So because we don't know an individual's particular rate of elimination, we use a maximum and a minimum, a fast and a slow elimination rate. And so our results for this calculation are always expressed in a range to ensure that that individual's actual blood alcohol concentration lies somewhere between the range that we provide.
And can you please explain sort of that range and the size of it for the jury?
The range that's provided as part of these calculations, the size of the range depends on the facts of the case and the amount of time that's passed between the time of the incident and the time of the sample collection. The more time that's elapsed, there's a greater difference between the faster and the slower rates of elimination, the 0.01 per hour and the 0.025 per hour.
And what do those minimum and maximum blood alcohol concentration numbers signify?
They signify the smallest and the largest concentration that could be reasonably expected based on the blood alcohol concentration and the rates of elimination that are being applied in the calculation.
Now, were you able to perform a retrograde analysis from this defendant's alcohol blood testing from the Good Samaritan?
Yes, I was.
And similarly, did you perform that in conformity with how you performed prior retrograde extrapolation analyses in other cases?
Yes, I did.
And what time was utilized in your analysis as the time of vehicle operation or of incident?
12:45 a.m., January 29th, 2022.
And do you know where that time came from?
I believe it was the time specified in the request from the district attorney's office.
And why is time of operation or time of incident important?
Because the time interval that we use in the calculation depends on the starting and the ending point of that calculation. So the time of incident is important because that's what we're basing the math on.
And what was the resulting minimum and maximum numbers that you calculated for the defendant's blood alcohol concentration from her blood testing reading from the Good Samaritan Medical Center?
That based on the 93 milligrams per deciliter value that was obtained at Good Samaritan, that the blood alcohol concentration for that individual at 12:45 a.m. Could be between 0.14 and 0.28 grams per cent.
And so you calculated the defendant's blood alcohol concentration to be between 0.14 and 0.28 at 12:45 a.m. on January 29th, 2022. Is that correct?
Yes.
May I approach just to retrieve, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you, ma'am. I have no further questions.
All right. Ms. Giannetti?
Thank you, Your Honor.
And at this point, I'm only going to give you about 5 minutes.
I was going to ask the court to cut me off so that nobody's late today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon.
The Mass State Police Crime Lab you mentioned is an accredited forensic lab, correct?
That's correct.
That means that your lab has met specific internationally recognized standards for both quality and competence, correct?
There are aspects of quality and analyst competence that are addressed in the accreditation standards, yes.
It also means that your lab has demonstrated a commitment to best practices and to ensuring the reliability and accuracy of its forensic work, correct?
Yes.
And there are several requirements in order to become accredited, right?
Yes.
One of the most important requirements is an independent external review of your lab's quality management system, correct?
Yes, that's definitely one important component of the accreditation process.
That independent external review also evaluates your lab's technical systems, correct?
Yes.
And its procedures?
Yes.
And an external review means that experts from outside your lab come into your lab to review your work, right?
Yes, their review includes the procedures and the operating protocols, and there is some element of case file and specific work review.
Within your lab?
Correct.
And they make sure that you're following established and proper protocols, correct?
Yes.
Now, as a forensic scientist is one of your responsibilities to ensure compliance with the lab's administrative policies, quality assurance, and control requirements to make sure that you're complying with accreditation standards?
Yes.
And you take pride in your lab's accreditation status, correct?
Yes, it's an achievement that's obtained by the hard work of a lot of folks at the lab working together.
You make sure, or you do your best to make sure, that the lab is in compliance because you don't want to lose that accreditation status, correct?
Correct. It's important to ensure confidence in our results, to maintain the quality and maintain the accreditation.
Okay. In contrast to the accreditation standards for a forensic lab like yours, the standards for a hospital lab may be different, correct?
Correct. Typically, accrediting bodies for clinical chemistry or hospital systems are different accrediting bodies or different standards than forensic standards.
Okay. And a forensic lab exists for a different purpose than a hospital lab. Is that right?
Correct. They have different customers and sort of different scope or intention for the use of their results.
Sure. A hospital lab tests and analyzes blood for its use in diagnosing medical illnesses and for medical purposes, correct?
That's consistent with my understanding, yes.
Sure. And it's not for meeting court admissibility standards like your lab, right?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Your lab follows strict procedures that an expert from your lab can have confidence in the lab results when they come to testify in court like you're doing today, correct?
Yes.
As you testify here today, you have no information that the lab at Good Samaritan Hospital is an accredited lab, correct?
Correct.
And in addition, Good Samaritan Hospital is an external party in terms of its relationship to your lab, right?
Yes, and for that reason, the type of calculations that we performed based on medical records from Good Samaritan are outside of the scope of accreditation in the crime laboratory system.
Right. It has no relationship to your crime lab, the Good Samaritan lab, right?
Correct. The same policies and procedures are applied when our laboratory analyzes serum, or if we needed to do a retrograde extrapolation on testing that was performed internally that's covered by the scope of accreditation. But as you're mentioning, the testing was not performed in my laboratory. I don't have any direct knowledge or understanding of their QC procedures, of their accreditation requirements, or their testing procedures at all.
You anticipated my next question. So basically, you cannot personally vouch for the ethanol testing that was performed at Good Samaritan, correct?
That's accurate. The reliability of the results that my calculations were based on, my calculations are only as good as the numbers that I was provided. And like I said, the same math that I did here, I would do to my own internal standard or my own internal testing, anything that I performed testing on in the lab myself. But the results that I started from, I don't have any direct knowledge on their accuracy or reliability.
All right, Ms. Tianedi, we can bring Ms. Knowles back on Monday if you want. I don't want to cut you short. That was the time frame.
And I'm perfectly fine with that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And Mr. Lally, you're done?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Knowles, thank you very much.
You're all set.
You can step down. Ms. Tianedi, I think everybody appreciates that. All right, jurors, that's it for us for this week. I'll have to give you those cautions in a minute. I can tell you that it looks like next week we're full days every day. We don't expect as long a gap in between as we've had to do, so I think everybody should work really hard to make sure that doesn't happen. The cautions, please do not discuss this case with anyone. Don't do any independent research or investigation into this case. If you happen to see, hear, read anything about this case, please disregard it and let us know. Please be very careful with your social media use, and we'll see you on Monday. Have a good weekend.
And I will see counsel at sidebar.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.